This is Radio 4. It's 6:30.
Desert Island Wobblies. Introduced by Roy Seagull Noise.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? In tonight's edition of Desert Island Wobblies, my special guest is Ferdinand Boring. Currently a high-ranking person on the Radio Times, and formerly a human being.
Good evening, Ferdinand.
Good evening. No, that's my line.
Oh, sorry. Now, Mr. Boring, perhaps first of all we could turn to the...
Look, will you please stick to your own lines?
Oh, sorry. Very sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Ferdinand, today you're quite an important person on the Radio Times.
Look, for the last time, will you?
Yes?
Oh, I give up. Yes, that is correct, Roy.
I see. Well, I believe, for instance, that you are currently employed as the man who spits on producers' requests for more program publicity.
That is correct, yes.
And before that, you laid out the radio pages in your spare time, relaxed by writing the Lord's Prayer on the head of a pin.
Yes, correct is yes, that.
And you're shortly hoping to take over from the highly important man whose job it is to get a pair of nail scissors and cut out little jagged patterns down the side of each page.
That correct, yes, is.
Fine. Well, it's really wonderful to have you here on Desert Island Wobblies, Mr. Boring.
Thank you.
Now, as you know, the idea of Desert Island Wobblies is that you have to imagine you've been cast away on a desert island, and then tell me, in not more than 500 pseudo-intellectual statements, which six wobbly things you'd like to take with you.
Yes. Well, I gave this a great deal of thought, Roy, and the first wobbly thing I've chosen is this one.
Oh, I see. Yes. A very interesting choice, that.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm afraid I can't actually tell the listeners what it is, for reasons of a somewhat unwholesome nature, but you can take it from me. It doesn't half wobble. Fine. Well, moving on to your second wobbly thing, Mr. Boring, what did you choose for that?
Well, for the second wobbly thing, I think I'd have to plump for this one.
Ah, another wobbly thing which we can't mention, I see.
I'm afraid not, no.
Well, I am sorry about this, ladies and gentlemen, but it may help to say that this wobbly thing isn't quite as wobbly as the first wobbly thing he chose. Although, let's be honest, it doesn't exactly muck about, does it?
No, it's got a fair old dangle to it, I say.
Quite, yes. Probably because it's not used to being out in the light.
Right.
Well, moving on now to your third and fourth wobbly things.
Yes, here we are.
Right, fine, yes, thank you. I'm afraid we still can't tell you exactly what those two wobbly things just then were, ladies and gentlemen. Although I am permitted to say that will be all thank you, Doris. Now on to your...
Yes, sir. This program is the most disgusting thing I have ever listened to without fail every week in all my life. Unless the Burgess Way is immediately taken off the air, I shall personally send a letter to the Radio Times in real handwriting and ask for my fine as a BBC licensed dodger back. 50 years ago, when I was a younger version of the same miserable old faceache you're now listening to, we never had wobbly things at all. Our parents used to staple them all to the floor. And we used to respect them for it. And what's more, we used to beat them up. Yours sincerely, Joe Kendall, Chris Emmett, Nigel Reese, and Fred Harris. P.S. And don't you dare use my phone calls to sneak in your opening credits again.
Well, in view of that last call, the BBC butter up the listeners by sending them both a Christmas card department, have decided to take this week's edition of The Burkis Way to Dynamic Living off the air and replace it with...
We present a history of things through the ages, written by someone else other than Peter Clayton, and narrated in stereo by giving Richard Burton a single script to read.
1-1 of the most primitive imitative histories was the IITTVV production action. All you need is viewers.
In early 1964, American record producer Sid D. Mercenary began smoking lots of big cigars and changing his religion. The effect was immediate. In 1963, he had become a top impresario. He managed Diana Ross and the Supremes with the help of vitamin pills and was also responsible for The Who, or the Liberal Party, as they were then known, whom he continued to handle until the newspapers got to hear of it. Later still, in 1962, when Phil Spector's sound burst upon the public, he was one of the first people to open a window. I asked him what it was like getting paid 58p an hour to talk to the BBC.
Yeah, I remember 1959 very clearly. A lot of things happened that month. I remember there was a young married couple from Salt Lake City. The chick was one day frightened by a sink plunger and later gave birth to Mick Jagger.
What else happened that year?
Well, if I remember right, that was the year I had both my hands all bandaged up after an accident. And Julie Andrews brought out my favorite things.
Yes, it must have been quite a thrill. And I believe all the really big contracts were settled at parties.
Sure, as same as they are today, in fact.
Far out, Susie. That's really just too far out.
Excuse me, aren't you Mr. Ken Tasteless of the Exploitation Record Company?
Yeah, I am. What is it, lady?
Sorry to bother you, Mr. Tasteless, but I got a fantastic boy for you here. I tell you, he can make it really big.
That's no use to me. I only book singers. Say, what's in these cigarettes, tobacco?
Mr. Tasteless, look. This boy is walking dynamite. What's that, Rod? Rod, sure. I know. Leave it to me, Rod. Look, Mr. Tasteless, he's really gonna make it. Sing him something, Rod. Great, Rod, great. Hey, what do you think, Mr. Tasteless?
Don't waste my time, lady. Hey, Susie, ain't that Bobby Gentry over by the piano? What's she doing over here?
I hear she's gonna release Both Sides Now.
Boy, that I gotta see.
Mr. Tasteless,
yeah?
I'm beginning to think people are right what they say about you. You're damn ignorant. You don't know your...
Ignorant, my elbow. Look, lady, I'll be honest with you. You want me to spell it out? Okay. You're Mr. McEwen there. He's suffering with a bit of a handicap if he wants to make it as a singer.
Well, handicap, Mr. Tasteless?
Sure. You'd really have to try and dead him up a bit.
How do you mean dead him up?
Well, we record companies can't pull out all the stops with marketing and publicity until he's, you know, done a bit of dying.
Shut up, Johnny. I think Mr. Tasteless has really got something
right. You see, once he was dead, we could bring out all the tributes and stuff.
Yeah.
Here, look. Let me give you an idea. What's his name?
Rod Earplug.
Rod Earplug. Right. Hey, Sam. Show these guys here what I mean, will you? You just listen to this.
On the 31st of January, 1978, I was driving home when a news flash came over the radio. Rod Earplug has been run over by a steamroller and crushed to death at a road widening works on the B-5120 just off the Yoxford intersection. Rodney J. Earplug was dead. And a flame went out in my soul as I heard how he'd been flattened out and spread across the tarmac like a Dover sole that's had an argument with a kitchen mangle. Like a 15-stone apple strudel that's been accidentally left on Cyril Smith's chair. Rod Earplug, why did you have to go? Why did you have to get squeezed into two dimensions? Why did you have to end up looking like a fat version of the ham in a BBC sandwich? Why did you have to get squashed beyond...
Stop!
Well, All You Need Is Viewers charted the progress of the pop world's answer to music, other historians of things through the ages devoted their documentaries to more elevated subjects. The historian who made The Ascent of Man was one of them.
One of them.
Oh, sorry. One of them. And outstanding among his chronicles of human achievement was his feature on Charles Darwin.
Diary of Charles Darwin, January the 1st, 1831. Set sail on the Beagle. January the 1st, 1831. 10 days out of port, and Katie the cook has cut down on all the men's rations. So now there's a big queue outside the cold showers every night. January the 1st, 1831. 5 weeks at sea, and at last the captain has allowed us to say words like pork chop, greasy bacon, fried bread, and... Oh, God, excuse me. That's better. January the 1st, 1831. Beginning to think I should have got a more expensive diary. January the 1st, 1831. This morning, the captain called in to see me in my cabin.
Ah, morning, Darwin. How are your researches into evolution coming along?
Well, it's quite fantastic, Captain Stomach. During the course of our recent stops among the Galapagos Islands and the coast of Ecuador, I have closely examined hundreds of examples of naked ladies.
Naked ladies?
Naked ladies, yes. And I've studied the naked ladies very carefully and made a large number of drawings of them.
Of the naked ladies?
Well, exactly. And it's absolutely fascinating.
I see. What exactly does it tell you, then?
Pardon?
What exactly does your extensive examination of naked ladies tell you about the relation of contemporary morphology to the opportunistic mechanism of natural selection?
Well, nothing.
Nothing?
No.
In that case, what scientific use is it?
Well, it isn't any scientific use. I just happen to like looking at naked ladies, that's all.
Mr. Darwin?
Yes?
Could you cover that up with a sheet, please?
Only just.
Now, look, this obsession of yours with naked ladies, I might say that I am thoroughly and profoundly disappointed in you. And in fact, I've only got one question left to ask.
Yes?
Does this mean our arrangement for 8 o'clock this evening's off?
I'm afraid so. January the 1st, 1831. Today we dropped anchor at a little island just off the coast of the sea. Together with my young assistant, Miss Behavior, I straightaway set out to explore the landscape.
Ah, Mr. Darwin, there you are. I've been looking all over for you.
Look what I have found on the beach.
Good heavens!
Yes?
A grain of sand.
No. It's the remains of a gnat's skull.
A gnat's skull? Skull?
Precisely. Don't you see? This is the evidence I have been searching for years.
Evidence for what?
Evidence for my theory that humans evolved from gnats. Over the past decade, I've made a highly intensive investigation into gnats. How they eat, how they drink, how they respire, how British Rail tea is made. And it is my firm belief that man is descended from the gnat. Look, in here, I've got a collection of old fossils.
No, don't be so modest.
look, this here. Come closer. This is what I believe to be the skull of Peking gnat, which lived some 500,000 years ago. Yes, and this is the skull of Cro-Magnon gnat, 40,000 years old. And here now, we have the skull of Neanderthal gnat, 30,000 years old. And here is the skull of modern-day man. You see the uncanny resemblance. All I am searching for now is the missing link.
Missing link?
Yes, a creature halfway between a man and a gnat, which will add final proof to my theory. You see?
I think it's time I prepared your injection, Mr. Darwin.
What's this coming towards us? It can't be. No, it isn't. It is!
Eric Pold of Croydon.
Ah!
Buzz, buzz,
the incredible. It's incredible. The missing link. Tell me, Mr. Croydon, how long have you been alive?
Almost since birth, mate. I'm half man and half insect, you know.
Yes. I can see you've got three pairs of legs, but what does that make you?
Very well endowed, mate. Buzz.
Amazing. Buzz. Now, I understand you reproduce parthenogenetically.
That's right. Would you like to see my do-it-yourself kit?
Not this soon after breakfast, no. Tell me, what exactly do you prey on?
Sundays. Ah! I got that one in the parish newsletter, you know.
Well, misbehaviour, I'm afraid it looks as though we've drawn
here, a... I haven't seen no human life on this tropical island since Francis Drake.
Oh, Francis, he was the one who came over with the Golden Hind.
No, just a bit of a tan down the arms.
Well, there goes another theory.
An important history of things through the ages, although it didn't actually deal with things through the ages and wasn't actually a history, was Professor Galbraith's look at the economic trends of modern civilization, which caused the biggest sensation since Casanova added a new twist to the Kama Sutra. Galbraith's searching insight into capitalism underlined the complexities of the world of commerce and big business.
Right, order, gentlemen. Gentlemen, order. Now, I'd like to start this
board of directors?
Yes, better make it Watners. Now, I'd like to call to order this annual general meeting of the governors of Harrob's Department Store, brackets by appointment to God. And first of all, I call upon our auditor, Mr. Female of Woman and Woman, to give a resume of last year's sale figures.
Well, I'm afraid 1977 was a very disappointing year for Harrob's Department Store, in that I'm afraid I have to report 573 products were sold.
Oh, dear.
Sold? You mean to tell me people actually bought them?
I'm afraid so, Mr. Sixhises.
Good God, that's preposterous. What's the point of us marketing hundreds of goods nobody can afford if people go and buy them?
What goods were actually sold, Mr. Female?
Well, let me see. 200 silk shirts at £60,000 each, 135 silk toenail cases at £80,000 each, 105 pairs of shoes at £500,000 a lace hole, with a choice of personal foot odor specially designed by Nosepeg of Paris, 63 pairs of £1 million checks, which you just strap to your feet so everyone can see how much you've paid, at £18 trillion each, and one 37p bottle of TCP on special offer at Harrods for £80 billion. Apparently, bought by Twiggy when she had a couple of pimples on her back.
Obviously didn't know whether she was coming or going.
Yes, quite. Well, let's get on to the other matter. Oh, damn, I've spilt the ink bottle all over this sheet of paper. Iris, better stick it on the front of this week's Sunday Times as part of our spring clothes collection.
Yes, sir.
Now then, the thing is, gentlemen, we've had a request from one of our more important customers, not a million miles away from this building here. At the end of the mall, A certain personage who shall remain queenless, who has asked us to design a new budgie for her. Now, as you know, I put out the tenders to the architects a month ago, and here with us this afternoon to show us what he's come up with is Mr. Expensive Coffeepot of Not Poulsen and Not Poulsen.
Yes. Well, here is a prototype model of the budgie I have designed for you here.
Thank you. Well, now let's have a look, gentlemen, shall we? Two big horns on the head, I see, yes. A bit of a fat, patchy black and white body with a not wholly invisible udder on the underside, a swishy tail, and four cloven-hoofed legs dangling down, one from each corner.
Yes.
This is your firm's design for the new budgie, is it?
Yes.
Fine.
We do design a lot of horses, you see.
Horses?
Yes. Not terribly good horses, I'm afraid.
I tell you what, let's give it a try, shall we? Who's a pretty boy, then? Yes. I'm sorry, I couldn't quite make that out.
It said, Joey boy is.
Joey, boy, is that Joey spelled J-O-E-Y?
Oh, no. Joey spelled M-O-O-O.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, let me try. Who wants his nice cuttlefish, then, eh? Who wants his nice cuttlefish? What did he say?
He said Joey wants his cuttlefish.
Spelled?
M-O-O-O.
This spelling handicap seems to be rather hampering it in budgie terms. I tell you what, let's just see how it flies, shall we? Open the window, Mr. Female.
Right.
Out you go, Joey. Come on, out you go. Well,
it usually migrates about this height of the building.
Migrates?
Yes.
To the ground?
Yes. Mm.
Something tells me it's high time we moved on.
And, of course, finally, the history of things through the ages, without which this history of things through the ages would be complete. The award-winning documentary, Royal Heritage, with Hugh Owl Resemblance.
In the reign of King George III, many royal heirlooms and priceless treasures of the crown were plundered when the ships carrying them were lured onto treacherous rocks and ransacked by the wreckers. Although the punishment for wrecking and smuggling contraband was grisly torture and death by waiting to be served in Sainsbury's, one of the biggest, most desperate bands of outlaws continued to flourish at Dymchurch, a remote village on the south coast. These men were led by the notorious Dr. Sin, alias the Scarecrow.
Be the password.
Intimacy is an Irishman making two planks of wood.
Oh, thank you. Intimacy is an Irishman making two planks of wood.
Correct. You can come in.
Thank you very much.
Now, I think we're all here now. Let's go over our plans for tonight's wrecking. Chromosome Joe?
Yeah?
Have you got the dark lanterns?
Yes, Dr. Sin. The dark lanterns are right here.
Let's see. Oh, no, that's no good. You can still see the light. Better cover them up completely. All right? Now then, Silas, have you got all the ammunition?
Yes, Dr. Sin. I've drawn the cocks on me pistols.
All right. If anything goes wrong tonight, you can always get a job writing feed lines for Celebrity Squares.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you.
So, is everything clear? Chromosome Joe, you take 6 men to the beacon on Hangman's Cliff and douse it, while Silas and the rest of the crew gather on the beach to row out to wreck for plunder. Then, as the boxes are brought ashore and the rear guard keep a lookout for the King's men, I dress up as a scarecrow.
Isn't that what you did last time, Doctor?
Yes.
Dress up as a scarecrow?
Yes, a scarecrow. I mean, let's face it, where would you be if I didn't dress up as a scarecrow? Eh? Crows all over the place, ruining the wrecking.
I don't think they'd really hurt, Doctor.
Oh, of course they would. How can you expect me to douse a beacon with hordes of ferocious crows springing terrifyingly from their trees, growling horrendously and flexing their massive claws?
I don't think that's crows, sir.
Yes, it is. Those black things.
I think that's panthers, sir. Crows are small black birds.
Oh, those. Oh, yes. Well, not really much chance of crows massing in great flocks and ferociously attacking people from the surrounding trees, is there? Oh, that's funny. Where did Hitchcock go? Anyway, off you all go to the beach while I stay here and put on these lovely, gorgeous, ragged trousers with delicately fringed holes in the knees. And, so off you go.
So long as it's not a fetish.
Ruddy Nora, of course it's not a fetish.
All right, then. If it's not a fetish you've got about scarecrows, why do you keep taking all those Polaroid photos of old brooms?
I do not take Polaroid photos of old brooms.
Yes, you do. You take them because they're nude scarecrows.
Arr.
You got a perversion about scarecrows.
For the last time, I have not got a perversion about scarecrows.
In that case, stop fondling that pin-up of Patrick Moore.
Black dodges. I've had just about as much as I could take of these disgustingly smutty japes. When I was a boy, we didn't go out dressing up as scarecrows like Joe Kendall, Chris Emmett, Nigel Rees, and Fred Harris. In those days, we used to go off and beat the hell out of foreigners. And it did us all a power of good, I can tell you. What those young scriptwriters, Andrew Marshall and David Renwick, need is a dose of national service. It certainly taught me the meaning of the word discipline. And as for your producer, John Lloyd of Europe, I've told him before about using my phone calls to secretly slip in his silly closing announcements. I remain, yours disgustedly, Norman, same character as at the beginning, Cell 5, the Radio 4 Listeners' Ward, London, 1906.
This is BBC Radio 4. Well, there'll be another...
Dear sir, I must complain until I'm blue in the tie about that last reference to BBC. The letters B, B, and C, as we all know, stand for three words which are totally disgusting, and in most houses, obscenities. I mean, of course, British Broadcasting Corporation. Why can't you use a nice, decent continuity announcer for a change? Someone we Radio 4 listeners can identify with. Yours, on the verge of humanity, a man even I'm getting a bit sick of by now.
Right. We'll do our best, sir.
Dear sir, this is Radio 4, and you can hear another edition of The Burkist Way at the same time next week. Although not if I have anything to do with it, because if I have anything to do with it, you'll never hear the damn thing again. And just to make sure, I shall come round next Tuesday at 6:15 and kick your ears in. Yours, with foam dribbling out of my mouth, a nice, decent continuity announcer, who Radio 4 listeners can identify with.
So we said, ah, the bidding...